This is Mary Nielsen, lecture on the sixth and seventh step of the 12-step program, titled, Do You Want to Get Well? It was very interesting this morning. The Bible study, for those of you who were there, was about blind Bartimaeus. And the question that Jesus asked him when he finally got through the crowds and got to Jesus was, yeah, come on in. was, what do you want me to do for you? What do you want me to do for you? And I thought about that. I mean, it seems like an obvious question, and it's obvious in the same way that the text that I was planning to use for today is obvious. And yet I thought about how I would have answered that 12, 15 years ago. If Jesus had said to me, what do you want me to do for you? I would have said, fix my son, fix the family, fix sexism in the world, do all of these things out there. Fix my world so that I can live with serenity. That's what I would have told Jesus to do. Bartimaeus said, please let me see again. And you can look at that, think of that either physically or metaphorically. But he was responding in the right way. He was saying, Jesus, do what you can do for me. Change me so that I can relate better to my world, so that I can see my world, so that I can live that way. I wanted to read another healing story that was always such a puzzle to me when I was a child, and I think it fits in very well with the seventh and eighth, or the sixth and seventh steps. It's from John 5. Now in Jerusalem by the sheep gate there's a pool called in Hebrew Bethzatha, which has five porticos. In these lay many invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been ill for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to be made well? Do you want to be made well? Now, when I was a child, every time I heard that story, I thought, what a stupid question. I mean, Jesus is supposed to know everything anyway, right? But, even so, why would he even think to ask, do you want to be made well? Of course the man would want to be made well. The man doesn't answer directly. He just says, sir, look at my condition. And then Jesus says, take up your mat and walk. And the man in faith then takes up his mat and walk. But let's think about why Jesus asked the question, do you want to be made well? And that, I think, will lead us into this study of the sixth and seventh steps. What did the man have to give up? Ideas. If he became well, how would his life change?
Do something constructive with his life to earn money and not be sitting around the pool all the time.
Right, he'd have to quit hanging out at the pool. He'd have responsibilities. What else?
He'd have to relate to well people.
Okay, what else?
If he was deriving some satisfaction or a lot of sympathy or whatnot from his listening.
Okay, he'd have to give up his sympathy.
Experiencing the unknown.
He'd been ill for a long time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All kinds of very good reasons why he might not have wanted to be made well. The sixth step, and I'll read those to you because we don't have enough handouts, I guess, for everybody to have them. Is we became entirely ready to have God remove all our defects of character that prevent us from having a peace-filled life. And the seventh step is we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. The sixth step talks about being entirely ready to have God remove all the defects of our character. In other words, it suggests that we are ready to begin to live in the image of God, which we've been talking about for all of this time together, that our work becomes energized by love, and love is manifested in our work. That we become people that we were created to become, people in the image of God. That we are ready to have God begin transforming us and making us into new creatures. For those of you who weren't here last week, let me do a quick review of the first five steps. The 12-step program, as most of you, I guess, know, was formulated in the late 1930s by the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was discovered, I think, that this was the way that people lived who did gain sobriety. It was a formulation based on observation. And then it became a formulation that produced a behavior rather than the observation of behavior. But the people who became, the alcoholics who became sober after going through this certain process. And it seemed to be the only thing that really worked. People have been struggling with alcoholism for thousands of years. And all of a sudden, there was a way in which people could walk to gain sobriety. Now, the 12 steps is not a cure for alcoholism. It's a spiritual path that allows an alcoholic to live a sober life. It's a spiritual path that allows us all to live a serene and peace-filled life. And that's why in our church, we use the 12 steps for all kinds of people, for anybody that wants to be involved. Think of yourself as a house in which you've lived for many, many years. And if you're at all like us, you clean house when you move. Or maybe you're not like we are. This house has been just let go for a long, long time, and the basement is so full of junk that you haven't noticed huge cracks in the foundation. And the radon gas is leaking in, and all kinds of bad things are happening. And the roof is leaking, but there's so much stuff in the attic that you don't notice it until pretty soon the plaster is all falling down in your bedrooms. So what happens is that you finally are in such bad shape that there really is no denying that you need help and no way that you can patch things up yourself. You finally have reached what they call in the 12 steps, the first step. We admit that we're powerless over something in our lives, that we can't fix it ourselves. We try to do what we can, but we can't do it. We just can't fix it ourselves. Now, for the alcoholic, that thing that needs fixing is the urge to drink alcohol. But all of us have some things in our lives that we attach ourselves to. I was just listening to the lecture by Jane Stroh, and she talked about the Lutheran concept of original sin being the notion that we are unable to love, trust, and honor God. So that is sort of the basic crack in our foundation, that we cannot love, trust, and honor God. And Calvin went on a step further saying, but we are very capable of loving and trusting and honoring. It isn't that we're incapable of loving, trusting, and honoring. It's just that we love, trust, and honor something else. And those something else's become our idols in some people's language, in 12-step language. They become our attachments or our addictions. For some of us, that might be security. For some of us, that might be food. For some of us, that might be prestige. For some of us, that might be, what are some other things? Just throw them out.
Chemicals, sex,
a relationship, controlling another person, hooked into another person. All kinds of things that we become attached to. The second and third steps involve coming to believe that there is someone, and as Christians we believe that someone is the God that we have come to know through our study of the scripture and through our own experience, who can do the needed repairs. And so we turn our house over to the care of God. And the first thing that God tells us to do in the 12-step path is to get busy and start house cleaning. That there's all kinds of stuff that we can do. And that is the fourth step. We start going through this mental house of ours and looking at what we've got. What's good and what's bad, what needs to be thrown out, what's garbage, what's causing problems, and so on. So the fourth step is that fearless moral inventory is what it's called in fourth step language. But what it is just taking a super flashlight and going through our mental, emotional, and spiritual house and seeing what's there.
It's what the moving company does when they come to move you.
Yeah.
Go in places where you haven't been for a while, and they look in places to take that inventory.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
They get it all down.
Yeah, yeah.
It's stuff you've forgotten about.
It's amazing. It's embarrassing is what it is. Exactly. The fifth step, which is confession to God, self, and another person, the exact nature of my wrongs, is that time when we throw out all the garbage. When we get rid of the guilts and the pains and the resentments, the angers, all of those things that have been eating us away. And we let them out. And we experience the wonderful rush of forgiveness that God can give us when we finally confess and admit and let go of all that trash that we've been holding on to for a good share of our lives. The fifth step is the kind of house cleaning that we only do when we move. And in a sense, it is the step that allows you to move. It's the step that gets you moving on. And in treatment centers, they used to say, and unfortunately a lot of treatment centers aren't doing fifth steps anymore, and I think that's a very sad thing, but they used to say that if a person could get through a fifth step, an honest, deep, meaningful fifth step, that their chances for a recovery life were just infinitely greater than if somehow they couldn't do it or wouldn't do it. All the steps are turning points, but the fifth step is a very dramatic turning point, I think, for most people, a great moment of release and of freedom. So that brings us to the sixth and the seventh step. Our goal is to be able to live as people created in God's image. That's our goal, is to live as nearly and as closely as we can in the created self, the self that is good. What the fourth and the fifth steps have done for us is to isolate particular defects in our character that seem to be habitual. We can't do this looking through our house without finally discovering some of those cracks in our foundation, some of those things about ourselves that we really fall into all the time. Now, for all of us, we experience resentment from time to time. I mean, that's just a very common human emotion. But some of us hold on to it, and resentment is basic to our personality. We live in that resentment. All of us feel anger some of the time, but some of us have anger-based personalities. We are energized by anger. Anger is what drives us and what motivates us, and we live in that pool of anger. We all make judgments about others occasionally, of course, but for some of us, intolerance and judgmentalism and maybe even self-righteousness are a way of life. They're core personality traits. They're what we're hooked onto that as a self-image. And of course, those traits block off the flow of love into us and out of us. I think all of us worry about money from time to time. We worry about security. We've been sitting now with a financial consultant, now that we're done dumping $20,000 a year into college tuitions, we have people saying to us things like, you ought to be planning for your retirement. And it's just a very odd way of thinking. I mean, we've never thought that way before. And it's a very seductive way of thinking. It's very seductive to start planning. Financially planning, and how much will you need, and figure in inflation, and all this kind of stuff. Some people think about those things once in a while. Some people are obsessed with them and think about them all the time, and can't let go of anything because they need to have that financial security that they need to have. So those are the things that you discover about yourself as you're doing the fourth and fifth step. You label what those things are about yourself. We all have these cracks in our foundation, defects that need tending to, and that never changes. You know, we'll go through our whole life, and I think Jane made a good point of that this afternoon, that somehow we are always going to be sinner, in Lutheran jargon. Somehow we will always have this tendency to attach ourselves to something, which is the 12-step way of saying the same thing. But that doesn't mean we need to sit in the same silly way of living our whole life. We can change and we can grow and we can be transformed, and that's the promise of God. That's the promise of God. The sixth step says that we're entirely ready for God to remove these defects of character. And on the surface, as we've talked about, it seems like this would be the easiest step of all to take. Just as it seemed obvious to me that the cripple would want to get well. Why, of course, you know. But it isn't obvious at all. Because every defect of character that we have for a reason. We developed it for a reason, and we've kept it for a reason. And every defect of character we have gives us some positive kick. And in order for us to be ready to give up the defect, we have to be ready to give up the kick. Does that make sense? Just for instance, and then I'll give you an example before we get into this brainstorming, when I'm going to, you know, expect you all to wake up here and get out of your metabolic slump, post-dinner slump here. People who have tempers, you can say all that you want to say about how I wish I could control my temper. I wish I didn't have this terrible temper. But if you're going to give up a temper, you are also going to give up an enormous amount of power over other people. Because whether you're using your temper or not, if people know you've got one, they're going to tiptoe around you. They're not going to cross you. They're going to do what you want them to do. People with tempers are able to have an enormous amount of power within their family structures or in their employment or wherever they are. So if you ask God to give up, to take away this temper, you have to be ready to give up the power and the control that temper has given you all those years. You maybe aren't ready, you see. And then you just sit with that crack. You just sit with that defect until you're ready to give up the kick. Does that make sense? Is there somebody here that is much better at printing legibly than I am? My handwriting's a joke. My daughter can write much better than I can.
She's gonna save it.
Yes.
Are you ready to start?
Yes. So I will move out of the way here. And why don't we start first brainstorming a list of defects, and then we'll go back and we'll try to figure out what the positive kick is that these different defects have. You don't need to necessarily be, well, let's say, why don't we start out with the defects of our spouses? That makes it easier to talk about. We don't need to be talking about our own defects. Or should we just say defects in general?
Yeah.
Safer. Especially if your spouse is here.
Especially if your spouse is here, right. Yeah. Okay, throw out a few.
Pride.
I don't know.
It's a loop is still
right.
A.
We know.
All of our perfectionism.
Yes. Not that you're troubled with that particular trait.
Anger.
Anger. Mm-hmm.
Anxiety.
Worry. Mm-hmm.
Fear.
Yeah, did we get fear down? Yeah.
Okay, I have all those. No,
we don't.
Laziness.
Gossiping. And laziness. Yeah.
Perfectionism or
no. Oh, how about masks? Masking. Would that be it? Yeah. I mean, we all do that to a certain extent, but for some people, those masks are so thick and so heavy and so, yeah.
I work with one right now.
Not that you're judgmental.
I have this friend.
Okay.
I'll try to get him to come to
Yeah. So that they can get fixed. And Jesus asked, what do you want me to do? And I said, fix that person. Okay, let's go back and talk about what the positive kick is from each of these defects. Why it is that we would not want to give them up. Again, brainstorming notions. What's the positive kick in pride? Superiority, I think, is the kick. And also never having to look at yourself. You know, I mean, you keep your mask in place.
Denial,
yeah. That's the right word.
I'm okay, you're not.
What?
I'm okay, you're not.
Yeah. This is a bit different than most of them in that, you know, we think of a lack of pride as a more glaring fault, don't we?
Well, I think I would rather use the word arrogance.
Yes.
Would that be all right if we switched those words?
Yes.
Because...
That would help me a lot.
Yeah. Pride, I think we ought to have a certain amount of pride in what we do. And I mean, pride can, yeah. But arrogance, I think... And arrogance as a defect certainly allows you to feel superior.
Oh.
You know. And to have to admit that you are just like everybody else, that you're a part of the human family, you know, that's hard. That you aren't superior, that's hard. Okay.
It's false.
False superiority. Okay. What's the kick in resentment? Why do people hold on to resentments?
Power.
There's power to it. What else?
Revenge.
Everybody else is wrong, you're right. Exactly.
Allows them to rationalize their what they're doing. They wronged me, so I have the right to.
Right to be angry, to get back, to get even, whatever. Yeah, yeah.
It's almost a physiological kind of charge.
You
can get from resentment. The adrenaline. Start thinking about the number of different things, and it gets you all pumped up.
In the first lecture of this series, we were talking about the things that energize us, and that energy force can be love, which is what our goal is. But it can be all kinds of other things, and resentment is one of them. It energizes us. It's a rush.
Yeah,
you just feel it. It's physiological, and it feels good sometimes to be just doing.
When you resent somebody, you don't have to listen to what they say.
Mm. Oh, exactly. The other becomes an object. It objectifies the other. Yeah, and it's much easier to objectify the other than to see the other as a human being. Okay, let's go on. Perfectionism. What's the kick?
Praise.
Did you get praise? Right.
Approval.
All kinds of things in our society are geared to push that defect, aren't they? To make it seem like something good.
Conflict avoidance.
How does that work?
Well, because if you do everything perfect, nobody can...
Oh, right. Get on your case.
Right.
Okay.
Arrogant?
Yeah.
Oh, it's going away. It's even protection.
So, yeah, it's a protection.
Yeah.
It keeps distance. It distances. Well, in some ways, if you want to distance people, it can distance folks.
You might be rewarded monetarily.
There might be a good monetary reward, right?
Well, it's only so we can never go back.
Oh, you've discovered that.
I was taught that, but I thought I was two.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, why would anybody love me if I'm not perfect?
Yeah. That the way to get people to love you is to be perfect.
I know that my mommy and daddy wouldn't love me if I wasn't perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
And certainly daddy wouldn't love me if I wasn't perfect.
Well, who was the lecturer last week that talked about Santa Claus? You know, you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why Santa Claus is coming. You know, he sees you. All that kind of stuff, and we've mythologized, and of course we get that all mixed up with parents and with God and with all kinds of things. And so you're right. Be good for goodness sake, or people aren't going to like you and they're going to punish you, and you're going to get ashes and switches. So we push that trait. And just cripple people with it.
Somehow I think I'd like my neurosurgeon though to have that.
Perfectionist trait?
Sure.
That's just great.
Well, it's interesting. I think that you can be a highly skilled professional and not be a perfectionist.
You don't really care how your neurosurgeon organizes his socks.
Just in that area.
That's another story, but
well, you get good enough in that area, you don't need God anymore.
Right. Yeah, it's a very works righteousness sort of thing. Let's go on to people pleasing. What's the kick?
Approval.
Approval, absolutely.
Esteem.
Total conflict avoidance. I mean, if you spend your whole life pleasing everybody around you, not making anybody mad, then you're never going to get in conflicts with people, are you?
So you'll never
accept yourself.
Accept yourself. Yeah. What else? What are the other kicks that you'd have to be able to give up if you were going to give up the negative trait of people-pleasing?
People won't like you.
Exactly.
You'd have to deal with, people not like you. I don't know if they still say this in treatment centers or not, but one of the almost universal traits of alcoholics was that they were people-pleasers. And that's a trait that just drives you crazy.
It's a need to be needed.
What's the kick of being a caregiver? Feeling needed, right?
Caretaker,
I suppose. Is that the?
What were you thinking about in terms of the defective?
Yeah, caretaker.
What you're talking about is a person who is a codependent.
Taking care of people instead of nurturing them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like taking over their, the kick is that I'm kind of controlling that person's life. I have control over that person because I'm taking such good care of them that I know what their needs are.
Mm, it's control. It's being needed. Superiority.
I know what's best for you.
I know what's best for you. Yeah, and I will take care of you. Yeah. Anything else? What about disloyalty?
Power of effort to.
Adventure.
Adventure, power.
Just doing what you want without regard for anyone else.
Mm-hmm. That rebel. That there's a certain kick in rebellion, isn't there?
Adventure addiction.
Yeah. Risk taking.
Risk taking.
Yeah. How about dishonesty? What's the kick?
Well,
the risk.
It depends on what you're being dishonest about. Sometimes it's the risk. A lot of times, if you're being dishonest about yourself and about your own feelings, it all ties in with the conflict avoidance. It just depends on what you're being dishonest about.
Well, it can tie into grandiosity too, making yourself feel or seem like more than you are.
Right, exactly, yeah. I never have problems, I never, yeah. What are the kicks in workaholic behavior? Ooh, success.
Total success.
Total success. Esteem.
Praise.
Praise.
Escape.
Escape.
Identity.
Identity. Ooh, our culture feeds that one big time.
I am what I do and how much?
Yeah. Instead of a human being, right. Yeah. What else? Anything? I can see we're not going to get through this whole list. Do you get the idea? Are any of these ones you want to talk about in particular?
The next one.
The next one, living in fear. What is the kick in living in fear?
Avoidance.
Avoidance would be one, yeah. If you're fearful, you avoid doing all kinds of things. It's a safety, a security. Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes there's almost, again, the physiological part of that is kind of the adrenaline that's produced by having that fear present, that anxiety sort of a, kind of a constant presence, and may produce some kind of...
You know, and if you're people like I am, and what used to be more than I am now, who have an incredible adverse addiction to boredom, who fear boredom more than anything else. Boredom is that sense of being not alive, of not having a rush of anything going on. And so fear is a rush. It says to me, I'm alive, you know? And that's better than being absolutely dead.
And that's another reason to be a workaholic.
Mm-hmm. Sure. All kinds of...
Or a risk taker.
Or a risk taker, yeah.
I go skydive today because I'm bored.
Yeah. What about anger? I think that that's a very important one because a lot of us live in anger.
Control.
What's the kick?
Control.
Again, that wonderful rush. I mean, anger produces infinite amounts of adrenaline. Gives you that feeling of being alive.
If you express it.
Vital, yeah.
But
if
anger
you stuff
can
it,
also be
you're in trouble.
If you don't know how to express it, it's got the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You can also feel, if you suppress it or if you express it, you feel like the world owes you something.
Right.
Because you've been wronged.
Mm-hmm.
Or you feel angry about something, so.
Yeah. Exactly. Anything else?
Low self-esteem.
What are the kick? Oh, that, yeah. What's the kick in low self-esteem? That's very much like the cripple. Do you want to get well?
No, I'd rather stay angry.
What?
No, I'd rather stay angry.
Than have low self-esteem?
No.
Pride yourself on being humble.
You can pride yourself on being humble. You don't have to take risks, you don't have to be all that you can be, you don't have to stretch yourself, you don't have to grow, you can always say, I can't, I don't, I, you know, for me, is incredible escape in low self-esteem.
Don't try not to humble me.
Yeah.
that's a trait that many of us grew up with. Be humbler than thou.
Yeah.
But it's false. It's a false sense of humility. It goes back to that first one. Really is healthy pride is being able to be okay.
Yeah, to take a compliment, to say thank you. Yeah. I mean, the Norwegian, you know, this is sort of like being a recovering Norwegian.
Right.
The Norwegian way, you know, you say, oh, this is a wonderful meal. Oh, well, no, it really wasn't enough. Or, you know, it could have been better.
Oh, God.
I tasted better last week.
wait.
Yes.
Because you talk about that, because really what you're doing is trying to fish for a compliment. No, it really is good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was much better than that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay, that's the last time I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other ones that you want to talk about specifically?
Selfishness.
What's the kick in selfishness?
Well, it's like being a two-year-old. You just get everything you want.
Right. Throw a temper tantrum and you get what you want. You don't need to think about the needs of another.
Or the consequences.
Or the consequences of your behavior. Yeah. Exactly. It's a very protected way of living.
Back to the kick of being humble.
Well, don't use the word humble because that's a good word.
Okay. False sense of humbleness. I don't know what to say.
Yeah. Thinking less of yourself than you ought.
Low self.
Yeah.
Yeah. Humble is a good word, unless it's been so impressed upon you that that's the absolute best thing to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was adopted into a Lutheran Norwegian home, and I am not, my...
So now you're a recovering Lutheran Norwegian, yeah.
And so, I learned to be in control and to be very humble and a number of things, and I really do think that sometimes a lot of things, if overdone, are somewhat cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they can become negative things.
Oh yeah.
For us.
Oh yeah. And most of them start out good.
Yeah.
Most of them start out good. Yeah. In many ways, the Exodus story is an incredible metaphor for the whole 12-step program. What started out as good, which was going to Egypt to get food, the people would have starved, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. People would have starved if they hadn't gone to Egypt and gotten food. What started out as being a good thing turned into slavery because they stayed too long.
Mm-hmm.
They got comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
It was an easy life. And they started to lose their identity, right? And something happened that was outside of their control. Things changed. And all of a sudden, they were hooked. They couldn't get out without the help of God. And so as a metaphor for addiction, that's a powerful metaphor. And then when you think of recovery as being the journey through the wilderness, it becomes even more profound. Before we can reach the promised land, we must walk through the wilderness. And in the wilderness is where we learn, number one, to live one day at a time.
Yeah.
That only if we live one day at a time are we going to get through this, because we just get our food for a day. In the wilderness, we learn to live in responsibility to other people. We learn how to relate to other people, how to set up a society in which all people have rights and responsibilities, in a way that we never had to do before, because we were, in our addictions, we were so self-centered, we didn't need to think about the other. We didn't need to give to the other their self, you see. We didn't need to do that. So in all of these things, it's something that starts out good, it goes too far, something happens, and it turns on you. It turns on you. And then you need to...
Workaholism
Starts
out good. Work is good.
Work is good.
But then
yes, exactly.
We allow it to consume us.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. A little hand for the writer. Take the compliment.
Yeah.
Don't be self-effacing.
Oh, it was really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah. The second question that we need to ask ourselves, first question in the sixth step is, can I give up the positive kick? The second question is, can I give up the notion that I could do it myself? Can I give up the notion that if by self-resolution, by will, by going to more meetings, by doing the 12 steps, by whatever reason, I can fix myself? Now that I have figured out my defect, I will fix it. There's a book that I picked up in the library called The Codependency Conspiracy.
And all the way through, it talks about the 12-step program as a self-help group. And it uses that term in a very derogatory way. Well, it's missing the whole point of the 12-step group, because the whole point of the 12-step journey is that you give up the notion that you could do it yourself. And can I give up that notion? Can I ask God to fix me? Can I let go of the notion that I can do this myself? And can I turn it over to God? And so that's the next question that we have to be able to ask. And when we have reached that point where we can give up the positive kick and where we can truly turn this over to God, then things start to happen inside of us. And we don't notice it right away. I mean, it's not like aha or, you know, Shazam or anything like that. But it's like all of a sudden a benchmark comes along and you realize that you're different than you were a year ago or 3 years ago or 5 years ago. And you know that you're different. Like maybe your problem was that you could never rejoice in the success of another because somehow you were always just a little jealous, a little twinge, you know. Somebody else would get an award or somebody else would get a compliment and you'd smile and say how nice, and inside you're going, you know. And then all of a sudden it happens. You know, your spouse or somebody gets an award or a compliment and you feel real, deep, honest to goodness joy. And then you know that something has happened. Somehow you have been transformed. That old envy and jealousy really is gone. It's not that it won't ever come back again, but that you have these wonderful moments when you realize that, yes, it is gone. And I can live free of that defect that was controlling my life. In my case, I used to just live in anger toward the government. I mean, I saw governmental misuse of power everywhere I turned, and I loved that feeling of rage toward the government. Love that feeling. Just made me feel superior. It made me feel self-righteous. I knew best what ought to be happening. We ought to be out of this war, and we ought to be doing this, and we ought to be doing that, and we ought not to be doing that, and blah, 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 blah. Somehow in the last probably 5 or 6 years, every once in a while I slide back into that. But mostly now, I mean, the Iraq War was a real test. A real test for me. And there were a few days when I just plunged back into that old rage. It is really a debilitating thing. I mean, it does awful things to your insides. You know, we're not meant to live in that kind of rage. But mostly I can catch myself and I can say, what can I do? What can I do about this? Well, I can do this and I can do this and I can do this. What can't I do? I can't do this, 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 and this. And then I think about Jesus. What could Jesus do? And what couldn't Jesus do? Did Jesus overthrow the Romans? Did Jesus fix the hierarchy of the church? You know, I mean, why would I expect to be more than Christ? You know, one of the other speakers talks about how the world does not need another redeemer. It doesn't need another savior. We've got one. And people who live in that kind of rage expect to be more than God, more than Jesus was. And so I can let it go. I can turn it over. I can get out of that anger. And that feels so much healthier. And I know that something has happened that's better now than it used to be. My kids can call up and most of the time I'm okay with this, and once in a while I fall into it, with some major problem. And I can listen. And I can hang up the phone, and sometimes I feel a heaviness about it. But usually I don't frantically think of solutions. Usually I don't race off with plans for fixing them, you know. And 10 years ago, my mind never stopped thinking of plans for fixing my kids. Never stopped. I thought that's what I was supposed to be doing. I thought that's what it was to be a mother. I thought that's what it was to be a good mother. was to be always coming up with, you know, running defense and coming up with solutions. So the seventh step, if you're ready to take it, is that you ask God to remove the defect of character. And God's promises are sure. When we have done our readiness work, God can and will do God's fixing work. So the sixth and seventh steps are a one day at a time, a one defect at a time process, a lifelong process. And when we take the seventh step, asking God to remove a particular defect, it's important that we also ask God to give us something to fill that space. And you know the story about the evil spirit that was cast out and nothing came into the house and seven worse spirits came in? So that in this process, sixth and seventh step process, when we're ready and we ask God to remove our anger from us, then we ask also that God will fill us with joy. Or when we ask God to remove our intolerance and self-righteousness, we ask God to fill us with kindness and acceptance. So that the good quality is moves in and takes the place of the bad quality. And we know from the Gospel of Luke, when Jesus says to ask and you shall receive, he ends that by saying, earthly parent give us what they can, how much more will our heavenly parent give to those who ask, give the Spirit to those who ask? And in Luke, it's very specific about giving the Spirit. And so it is that Spirit of God, that Spirit in which we were created, that image of God in which we are created, that God has promised to give to us when we are ready and when we ask for that gift. I am feeling really sad that I used all this time and we can't break into small groups. We have maybe a few minutes for questions. I'd hope that we could get into groups and talk about our current defects and the kick we get from them. But there's a time.
This image that you were using of the house and the rebuilding and all of that kind of stuff, I think what's helpful for me is I think about that in allowing or asking God to be the one to remove the defects is like for me to call a mason to come fix the cracks instead of me doing it myself, because my tendency is to want to figure it out how I can do it. I mean, how do I mix the mortar and how do I get the stuff in there and how do I fix this, instead of giving up my control and wanting to do that myself and allowing someone else to come in and do it.
Let the pros come in and do it.
Yeah. I think that turning over, letting go for me is like having someone else come in to do, asking God to come in, someone from the outside.
This year we had to do it with our yard. We're not yard people. And 10 years, everything had died in our yard. It was just a pit. and so we had to call the landscapers and they came in and it's beautiful again. And it's in a way that we could never have done it. You know, they knew what they were doing. And God knows what God's doing. And God wants us to live free of those defects. That's God's will for us, that we live this abundant, wonderful life.
Yeah. The 12-step program gave you practical what-to-do steps when you find yourself in, well, let's say, overcome with fear. What do you do at that moment?
Well, where are some of our pro 12-step people around here? Can you speak to that? I sit here staring at you. Don't feel put on the spot. Well, the 12 steps has a lot of slogans, and they seem so almost childish at first. I mean, when I first came into the program, I was just nauseated by the jargon. And the longer I'm in the program, I try not to throw the jargon around a lot. But I've become so respectful of it. And things like one day at a time, and let go and let God, and keep it simple.
I just remembered that what I have to do, I have to go right to step one, over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
I am powerless to change or control this situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
Yeah, but back to step one. Yeah.
Sudden release and freedom. And I mean, my thing, you know, I think for a lot of us, almost all of these defects have some relationship to control. Mm-hmm. And when we're in trouble is when we can't control. And we're trying to control. Mm-hmm. And to acknowledge, I cannot control or change this particular thing. Mm-hmm. And then that's an opening for the rest of it to start working.
Is it possible that overanalyzing one's codependency can become a defect?
Oh, of course, anything can. And you wallow in the analysis instead of moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you head trip it instead of letting it get to your gut. And of course, that's a big problem with a lot of people. Yeah. They just keep things roaming in their heads.
Part of one of the jokes that I heard that helped illustrate that is that there are two signs that there's a sign that says heaven, and there's a sign that says lecture about heaven that all the codependents are lined up.
Yeah, they don't use the word codependent at Hazelden anymore, because people were just ripping themselves to shreds, you know, labeling everything within themselves, and it becomes very debilitating. It just becomes very debilitating, and it's not that that tendency is not a real thing, but it's much healthier to, I mean, like in our groups at church, we call them shalom groups. Because the name keeps us focused on the goal rather than on the defect or the dysfunction. And I think that's a healthy thing. And it's not that we're in denial over the dysfunction, I think. But I think it's important to always keep our vision on the goal and what God can give us.
If one analyzes their dysfunction till the day they die, they've missed out on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And
perfectionism comes into play all the time.
Yes, yes. I'm going to perfectly analyze every bit of myself. Yeah, yeah.
What you're doing with your shalom groups, is that a pretty unique approach, or do you know anyone else who is doing that out of the context of a specific
addiction?
A specific addiction.
Well, there are. When we started them, I thought it was a brilliant new idea, and I was just caught up in my wisdom, you know. Innovative idea, you see. But it turns out that there's a whole institute in Minneapolis that sponsors these kinds of groups. I'm glad we didn't know about that institute, because we were able to put together a program that I think is sort of uniquely meets the needs of our congregation in ways that a program brought in from the outside wouldn't have done.
Do you have any participation?
Hmm?
Is your participation fairly high? I mean, is it?
Well, it's outstretching the leadership. I mean, that's our problem right now. It's growing too fast.
These are general groups and not based upon particular.
No, anybody can come. So some people are people from AA or Al-Anon or NA or O, Overeaters Anonymous, okay. OA, yeah, or ACOA, who come because they want to be able to openly talk about faith issues, for one thing, and they want to do it in the context of the Christian faith, where they can talk about the Bible and talk about God and talk about in an open way. They don't need to mask everything with higher power and push theology out, which you sort of have to do in, at least I felt I had to do that when I was in Al-Anon, that I couldn't speak directly about my faith because it, well.
Well, one of the traditions says not to.
Right, yeah. So it can be a much more deliberate and conscious spiritual journey when it's set in the context of the church. And of course, the whole 12 steps comes straight out of the Judeo-Christian heritage. I mean, it's not like it's something new. It's the wisdom. When I was writing the meditation book, I wanted to have a meditation on every step every month. And I wondered if there would be enough verses that I could use to kick off meditations on every step. And, I mean, in Psalms, Proverbs, and Ecclesiastes, which were the three books I used, I could have written 2 years' worth. You know, I mean, I couldn't believe how much the biblical message fed the 12 steps or whatever. Yeah, you know, it's quite amazing. And now, sitting in church is a whole different experience than it was to me before, because I understand what it means to be in bondage to sin. That has a whole different meaning to me. Forgiveness has a different meaning. All of those things used to be words and ritual that was, you know, I mean, I liked it. I never disliked going to church, but I didn't really get the meaning of it. I didn't get it until I sort of walked in through the back door, you know.